You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Anyone who loves either poltergeists or 1980s horror films will instantly know what I'm referring to with the Entity Case and the ramifications of both the actual investigation and the film, which, how shall we say it, was rather loose in sticking to the facts in regards to the Doris Byers case. As the principal investigator, Dr. Barry Taff built a reputation as a diligent and persistent investigator who dealt with some of the most notorious poltergeist infestations in North America after gaining his doctorate from UCLA in 1975. We discuss his early experiments into precognition and remote viewing whilst at UCLA, the Entity Case in full, the infamous Jackie Hernandez San Pedro poltergeist, as well as the intriguing Holly Mont poltergeist, as well as some strange coincidences, especially in regards to the Twilight Zone. I've wanted to speak to Dr. Taff for quite a while, so I hope you enjoy this conversation about the paranormal, poltergeists, and much more. Now, before we get to the interview, I have a request that only you, the listener, can help me with. Halloween is coming up, and I've had a couple of emails asking me if I fancied doing a listener special episode in regards to experiences with the paranormal. So I thought, well, why not? Let's see what we've got out there. So, if you've had a spooky or ghostly encounter in your life, grew up in a haunted house, or accidentally picked up a phantom hitchhiker, I'd like to hear about it. Send me an email to mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com with the ghost story as your header. Make sure you put your experience in the body of your email, where you're from, and if you're happy for me to use your name. If you're not, I simply won't use it, or your location, just in case it gives it too many clues. Hopefully, we'll have enough so I can do you all a special ghostly edition just in time for Halloween. So don't forget, anything like that you might think I'd be interested in, just email me at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. Don't forget, you can find us on YouTube under Mysteries and Monsters. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can support the show via Patreon, and the link is in this week's show notes for bonus episodes and early releases of all the regular episodes. Artwork, as always, for the show is done by my wonderful brother Dean, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Now, let's join the legendary parapsychologist, Dr. Barry Taff, to talk about America's most notorious poltergeist hauntings. Today, I am both delighted and honoured to welcome Dr. Barry Taff to Mysteries and Monsters. Dr. Taff has spent his entire life investigating the paranormal and parapsychology, including several infamous cases, such as the Doris Byers case, the San Pedro poltergeist, and Holly Mont, amongst hundreds of others. Dr. Taff, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. As we were having a quick chat before, you, for me, have been one of the most notable names in parapsychology over the last 40 years. You were kind of drawn into this. You were having experiences and things when you were a child, I believe. Is that right?
Correct. Things were happening to me, some of which I could control, others I could not. And some of them got me in trouble. A good example is in grammar school, I think it was, you're 10 years old in the fifth grade, and I'm out playing, it's recess, and I'm playing with some friends in the courtyard, I don't know what, and this little girl's walking towards me named Christine. And I'm looking at her. She was wearing a blue, sky blue dress with a flower on the top. And I'm looking at her, and suddenly my vision changed, and I could see that under the dress, you could see a tube going into her right side and a big plastic bag there. So I went up to her and said, "Christine, what's that thing you're wearing?" He said, "What?" I said, "What's that strange bag and tube going into you?" She started screaming. She went in and got the teacher. They dragged me in the principal's office. And he said, "What, did you sneak in the girl's bathroom and look at her nude?" I go, "No, my vision kicked." And he goes, "You what?" Like, you know, Superman, X-ray vision. And went, "All right, look, I have to call your mom." So he calls my mom, and he tells her. My mom says, "Yeah, Barry can do that." And the principal went, "What?" He said, "Barry can do, what do you mean he could do it? He could look through people, look inside." And he said, the principal said to my mom, "What are you, as crazy or your son is? Are you people out of your mind?" So he hung up on her. He turned back to me and he said, "If this happens one more time, we're going to have you arrested and put in juvenile hall." So I looked at him and I said, "Well, you've got that weird scar where your appendectomy was." I called that a keloid today. I didn't know the word back then.
Yeah.
And he turned purple on me. And he said, "Again, if this comes up again, you're history." It did come up again, but I was wise enough not to open my mouth.
Yeah, yeah, keep your counsel.
So things like that, sometimes I could control it, some other times I couldn't. Mm. In junior high school, there's a girl named Helene, and every time she got near me, I would pass out, even if I didn't know she was near me. Turns out, she was epileptic. When I'm near people who are epileptic, I pass out, dizzy, because I'm very sensitive to it. But my being a medical intuitive is only part of the situation. What got me into this, really, was I wanted to know why myself, while not my friends and family, were having these experiences. What? Yeah. Why me? I mean, of all the people, why me? Why isn't anyone else I know talking about this? So, you know, what do? You just keep your mouth shut and you, whatever happens, happens. So then, in the late 60s, 67, I think, or in 8, I wrote a woman who ran the UCLA Parapsychology Lab by the name of Dr. Thelma Moss. So I wrote her a letter, nothing. I called the switchboard, nothing. But, you know, this is before they had email. This is long. This is in 1968, 7 or 8. So I gave up after about 3 or 4 tries. Well, and then turns out there was a graduate student in college where I was an undergraduate at the time who I met and told him what I could do and about my experiences. And so he said, "Do you have a phone number?" "Yeah, I'll give it to Dr. Moss." She called me, and I went to meet her at her Beverly Hills home, which was very close to where I live with my parents. I was like 5 minutes away, if that. So I met her. I knew nothing about her. I knew a little about her work, but nothing about her personally. So I sat down, and she said, "Do you do psychometry?" And I said, "Yes. You know, you hold an object, you get impressions." So I held the object, and I described some people and get names which were accurate. And then I said, "I see a fat, blue-eyed, blonde woman named Shelley screaming all the time. Who's Shelley?" That was a very close friend of Dr. Moss. It was the actress Shelley Winters.
Yeah.
It was an accurate, albeit rather insulting, description of her. But it was an accurate one, at least from my perspective. So Dr. Moss was impressed, and I began working as a research assistant in the lab after that. But at the same time, Dr. Moss was conducting a study on me, which was published in a medical journal in the mid-70s, about me being the telepathic precognitive. Okay, you can do this. And this was done at UCLA. And I discuss it on my website, barrytaft.net. So the whole thing, what's intriguing, it was supposed to be just telepathic, the research, the study. Turned out it was also precognitive, which is looking forwards in time. So they did some neurophysiological workups on me to figure out what was going on. And the EEGs were so bizarre that the journal that published the article that Dr. Moss and Dr. Eveloff wrote, the journal refused to publish the part dealing with my EEGs. I was generating about 1,000 microvolts at about 10 hertz, and normally that would cause people to be electrocuted or to go into massive seizures, which I've never had. So anyway, that happened. So that's how it all began. And then working at the lab, we did different types of research. Part of the work, which was done in the lab, was beyond the study Dr. Moss ran on me. We started developing, it's called the PSI training group, PSI training.
Yeah.
And I started applying some normal learning paradigm methods to see if we could teach people to be psychic. We could enhance whatever natural potential they may have. And this is on my website. The article is called Learned Psi Training to Be Psychic, and it goes into extreme detail on what we did. And it was amazing. Week after week, week after week, we got incredible results. And okay, so telepathic, okay, clairvoyant. You could see what, pick up what other people are thinking. You can access information remote from where you are physically. But then came the kicker. Now, let's start at the beginning. Different people were coming to our lab, to these sessions I was running, and they were dressed in civilian clothes. I didn't know who they were. Dr. Moss told me that they'll be coming down to do the watchers. Okay, great. So there were a couple of men and women. Didn't know who they were, and they gave us a strange name as a target. This is a sensory-deprived environment. You can't see or hear anything. It's pitch black. And we start describing in great detail, which is being recorded on audio tape, we started describing the details of a new ballistic missile submarine called an Ohio class, or the last nuclear subs they made, missile-carrying SLBMs. We were going into detail, and the session ended, and the people that gave us the target, they were a little uneasy because of the Trident system. We were describing the new sub under development that was classified. Now, we had her surrender the tape. Okay. So we know it worked.
Yeah.
So over time, we were able to do this on a very regular basis. And not with just the government, but we're doing it week after week after week. It got a little boring. So we tried one time. This girl came in. She worked in the lab. Dr. Moss sent her down. We knew who she was, but we knew nothing about her. So she gives us a target, and we start rattling off information. We describe the person. We try to phonetically pronounce the person's name, which we almost did. And then we describe a beautiful house in a very lush environment, a lot of foliage, just in a canyon, gorgeous, big glass walls. And then we see a large kitchen has the entire kitchen is lined with empty jars of Bako bits. Bako bits, okay. And we got no feedback yet. That comes at the end of the session. So then we describe the man being very, very intensely beaten and mugged. So at the end of the session, the girl that gave us the target, we gave her the remote control to the audio cassette, and we said, here's how it works. If you hear a statement that's accurate for the person you were thinking about it or yourself, and it's very specific, stop it and tell us about it. If it's not specific, don't stop it. Okay. So we just tape runs. We describe the person pretty accurate. We phonetically pronounced his name, or we tried to. And then the house was precisely accurate. He lived in a canyon area and going towards the beach. The glass walls, the kitchen was lined with empty jars of Bako bits, as we described. But this girl knew all of that. And, okay, so we're going with that. Okay, great. And then we come to the point where we're talking about being beaten and mugged. And the girl says, he's never been beaten. What are you talking about? Okay. So a couple days later in the lab, the phone rings. The girl's calling. Remember the other day when I came to the lab and you did target? Yeah. Well, the night it was happening, when we were doing the session, her friend was being beaten and mugged up in San Francisco. But the problem, bad as that was, the girl who was with us at the group, she didn't even know that at the time. How could she? So how did we know it? It's you're accessing information in space and time.
Mm.
And then we began to thinking, maybe this is a lot more than we thought it was. And we went on and said, let's try our first precognitive session. Let's see if we can accurately describe who is going to be the first target of the next week, the next session.
Yeah.
And it's all right. Well, we don't know who's going to be there. It says we don't know who's coming in, who's going to be randomly chosen. Mm. So we go into a turn off the lights, it's deadly quiet, can't see your face in front of your hand in front of your face.
Mm.
And, okay, we're doing this. And we describe a very tall, beautiful, blue-eyed blonde girl, dressed very in a beautiful, like a designer suit, like a fashion outfit.
Yeah.
And tall, about 5'9", 5'10". And we go in, and then we see a big three-story house in the Hollywood Hills with a baby grand piano. And then we see a tall man, well over 6 feet, maybe 6'4" or 6'5". And he's dressed all in black. Black pants, black shirt, black gloves, black hat, boots,
mm-hmm.
and black hat, black mask, and an imposing sword. And we thought to ourselves at the time, are we losing our minds? What are we seeing? So next week, new people come in that have never been in our group. They would have had to be brought in through third parties. No one who had been at the group recently. So each new person was given a sealed, opaque white envelope within which was a piece of paper with a number on it from 1 to 12. So people come in, they sit down in the chair they pick, except the one that has the audio controls that I'm in.
Yeah.
And they sit down, and we roll the dice, and we say to the people, open up your packets, and let's see what number, who got what number. We roll the dice, I forgot what number it was, and the people open up their packets, and this girl says, yeah, the dice fit my number. Okay, and we forgot what we said a week ago. Who remembers what you said a week ago?
Mm.
And so we told her, here's a recorder control remote. If the statement fits you, stop it and give us feedback.
Yeah.
The tape runs and we hear our voices describing the girl. It's her. Totally. It's good. Even her, the pantsuit she was wearing, her height, her face, her hair. There were 27 open chairs in our group, except one was taken for me. There were 26 available chairs she could have sat in of her own volition. She picked one. It was, and under each chair was a number. You couldn't see unless you flipped the chair over. We rattled off a number a week earlier. I forgot what it was. And the girl was not only fit our description, but she sat in the one chair we named a week earlier. But that could have been a coincidence.
Yeah.
Then we start describing the house. Yep, that's where she grew up. Baby grand piano. Yep, baby grand piano. And with the tall man in black with the sword and the cape and everything. And she turns to me and she goes, how do you know who I am? And I go, what are you talking about? How do you know who I am? And I go, who are you? She said, Tony Williams. I go, what? Tony Williams? What are you talking about? Well, who's Tony Williams? She goes, my father's Guy Williams. He went, oh my God. Her father played Zorro on the old Disney TV series in the late 50s. But she said, wait, when did you make this tape? A week ago. A week ago? I didn't know. It's going to be here till an hour or two ago. And then I got picked by Rand. I don't get it. That's the point. How could you see something that's not there? You can't. But we did.
Yeah.
And it made some people very nervous because it speaks of reality that's very different than what we thought it was. So it was impressive. We tried to do the same thing again sometime later. Not that day, but weeks or a month or so in the future.
Mm.
And we all start started seeing fire, fire, fire. We're losing our minds. What's fire?
Yeah.
Okay. The group ends. I'm up in the lab the next morning. Fire engines come to our lab. It was in the Neuropsychiatric Institute at UCLA.
Yeah.
And they come into the building. The room we were using for our research groups had caught fire. One of the outlets behind one of the curtains sparked, and it caused the room to catch fire. But we described fire the night before.
Yeah.
And you see, this is the problem. Bottom line with all this is, I could talk about this for days, but we've got to go on to the more intense stuff. The evidence suggests that information of space and time may be distributed in reality in a way we don't yet understand, wherein all of space contains the information of all space and time, sort of like a hologram,
yeah,
where the information is equally distributed. So that means you can access information from the past, from a distance, or from the future.
Mm.
But there comes the problem. How could we know what the past was? It's recorded.
Mm.
It's evident. We know it's at a distance. We can perceive that. But how could you see the future if it's not already there? And here comes the concern about free will,
yes,
versus predestination.
Mm.
And I've got a sneaking suspicion that in the end, when all this research is really well understood, I don't think a lot of people are going to like what the results are, because it'll tell us a reality that's very different from the one we think we live in.
Mm.
In that the future may be no different than the past. It's like we know the future is immutable. It cannot be altered.
Yeah.
What if the past is the same way? Quick story. 1970, I was in undergraduate college. I met a beautiful girl named Sharon in one of my classes. And we started dating. Everything was great. Then the dream started in me. This is important because this is what led me into this field. So in this dream, I see Sharon. I'm in the back seat of a car. I see Sharon in the front passenger seat. I see a driver. Couldn't tell if it was me. All I saw was thick, dark hair.
Hmm.
Couldn't see the dashboard. We turned down the street she lived down. It was a cul-de-sac in Northridge, California. Suddenly, a larger car comes flying out, hits us, and there's glass and fire and smoke. It's horrible.
Mm.
So I see Sharon all bloody in the passenger seat, and the driver's pretty much unconscious, and then I woke up. I kept having this dream over and over again. So I said, well, this isn't good because it's warning me.
Mm-hmm.
So after about six times, I finally briefed Sharon about this, and she wasn't pleased. She thought I was doing this as a way to stop dating her, because she lived, 22 miles away?
Yeah.
Who cares? Gas was 25 cents a gallon back then. Now, who cares?
Yeah.
I had a Z28 Camaro, great car, fun to drive, it was fun.
Mm.
So I said, I'm not going to risk our lives over a relationship. If we're dead, what good does it do us?
Mm.
So she got real angry and pissed and walked away, and I don't blame her. So I figured, okay, I've prevented what could have been a very bad situation for both of them.
Mm.
So sometime later, she started dating someone else, and they turned down the cul-de-sac to her home, and wham, there's the accident. Her new boyfriend is killed instantly, and she's badly injured.
Oh.
I didn't change a damn thing. I just misinterpreted the information.
Yeah.
I assumed because I saw her in the passenger seat that I would be driving.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case, so I misread the future. But this is a small example of things. This is discussed in my book, and I have another book I'm writing now which goes into more detail.
Mm.
How many coincidences make a fact?
Yeah.
100, 1,000, 1,000,000. This is what got me into this field. So when you get beyond the laboratory work, which is fascinating to no end,
yeah,
we go into another realm. And that realm is even more difficult to understand than the mental phenomena is. In parapsychology, there's two ends of it. One end is the ESP, the remote viewing, the telepathy, the precognition, all of that.
Mm.
Okay, the other end is a psychokinesis, mind over matter, remote influence, whatever you want to call it, and poltergeist, stuff like that, RSPK.
Mm.
And it's really rare to witness stuff, but if you're lucky and you go out enough, you might experience that.
Mm.
And I have to say, after 51 years of doing this, and all close to 4,500 cases, most of the time you go out, interview the people, and you go home, and that's it.
Yeah.
Or you go back to the lab.
Mm.
You hear their story, and that's it. But we know now what we didn't know then. What we know now is very clear. There is like a recipe. There's an equation, a formula before this phenomena happens.
Hmm.
And it's somewhat, the reason I'm saying this is so when I start describing the events, they may make more sense.
Yeah.
The formula is simple. Let me give you an analogy. If you got a DVD in your hand, you want to watch it, what do you need? Well, you need a DVD player. It's got to be connected to a television.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to be plugged in the wall. You've got to put the DVD in, use a remote to operate it, to see what's on the DVD. If any part of the ensemble is not there, you don't get a picture.
Mm.
In this real world, there are similar prerequisites. One appears to be an individual who is hypersensitive to electromagnetic field or geomagnetic field.
Mm.
The second is the individual is either seizure-prone or epileptic. It could be as mild as focal seizures, but not full epileptic seizures.
Mm.
Another parameter is the environment happens to be rather unique in that its amplitude or frequency is going up and down in on a frequent basis.
Mm.
And if you put all these together, you end up getting what I refer to as inductive resonance coupling, where it's a real term used in physics and engineering. This is where if your nervous system is the frequency is operating similar to that of the local magnetic field, you couple with it and things happen. Phenomena happened. And what's odd is that almost in the last life, we didn't ask this 50 years ago because no one thought to ask it, but I started asking about this about 28 years ago. The majority, if not all, of the poltergeist cases I've investigated fit this pattern. And it's so unusual that you could bet on it. You could use it, you could bet, and you'd win money with it. It's that consistent. It's amazing. Let me explain this. Let's see. I almost died several years ago, for medical problems. Thank God I didn't. But so I ended up moving after I was living in a hospital for 20 months. I had to go live with a friend, and he had never had a paranormal experience in his life.
Yes.
I moved into his home in 2017, and within 5 weeks, phenomena started in the home. Disembodied voices, luminous anomalies, machines starting and stopping of their own accord, water faucets turning on themselves, things like that.
Hmm.
But he lived there for, 14 years? Nothing had ever happened until I moved in. And then we moved to another house, and I thought, nothing will happen here, right? No. A couple months here, it all started up. It was even more intense here than the previous house. I'm going, why is this happening when I'm around my friend? I don't get this.
Mm.
So I've known the friend for 25 years, but I didn't know him that well. And I discovered last year that in the midst of all this, he fits the pattern. He has focal seizures, takes medication to quell these seizures, anticonvulsant. If he doesn't, he can't sleep. And I thought, okay, and when did the phenomena stop? When he stopped taking his, it started when he stopped taking his medication. He's the power supply and I'm the lens. I'm the focal plane. If I'm not around, nothing would be happening.
Yeah.
And in this house, yesterday morning, a woman calling my name wakes me up. There's no one in the bedroom with me. I'm alone. Who's calling my name? It's a female. What? 2:15 in the morning, a woman screaming the name Mikey. What? It just goes on and on and on. And one time we were in the kitchen and I'm looking past him into the dining room, which was pitch black because it was night, and suddenly the room lit up like someone fired an old flashbulb for a camera. Just pop. No source to the light. Now, let's go back to the first case I ever investigated was a couple in Pasadena in early 1969, I believe, yeah. Mm. And they had it, their cat died. Mm. They were really upset, and okay, that's terrible. And they said, but they were seeing her and hearing her. I'm going, oh, God. So are they really seeing it, or are they imagining it because they want the cat back?
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there. Suddenly, something jumps in my lap. I can feel the paws on my thighs. It's kneading, it's pushing. I can't see it, but I can hear it, and I can feel it, but I can't see it. Then it jumped off me, and the couch next to me went down as if it hit the couch.
Mm.
And then it was gone. So what am I to make of all this? The problem is that you can't prove, you can't disprove it.
Yeah.
But then we move on to more interesting cases. Probably the case that gained the most, I guess, public reaction to was the entity case. Now,
yes.
This is a case involving a woman named Doris Beither, B-I-T-H-E-R.
Yes.
In my book, it's chapter two called The Real Life Entity Case.
Mm.
And so my colleague was in a bookstore in Westwood with a friend of his talking about our research. This is in, early summer 1974.
Yeah.
And on the next aisle, a woman, Doris Beither, one of her friends, was hearing my friend's conversation. And he said, oh, you know, my house is haunted. And he went, okay, give me your name and number, we'll call you.
Mm.
So we call her, went out to see her on Braddock Drive in Culver City. Really hot, really humid. So I go in there, the house was very old and it was in need of repair, and it stunk. It smelled like decomposing organic matter or urine, just terrible odor. They didn't smell it. And the first thing she says when we sit down is, she said she'd been repeatedly raped by ghosts. And we went, what?
Yeah.
What? We rolled our eyes and, oh, God, it's a woman's psychotic and,
yeah.
You know. And so what do you do? Can't prove it. Now, Doris was very evasive, very cryptic when we asked her questions.
Hmm.
I asked her age, well, she wouldn't tell me. Okay, what do you do for a living? She wouldn't talk about it. In today's world, if the people I go out to investigate won't give us their age or what they do for a living, I get up and leave because they're wasting my time.
Yeah.
But those days, we were a little more open-minded. And so we listened to her, and okay. And we told her, look, we don't really handle the problems you're having. You need to see a psychiatrist.
Mm.
What? I said, it's not paranormal. This is psychiatric.
Yeah.
You know, you need psychological. So, okay, she thanked us. We left. But 10 days later, we get a call from her. Some neighbors had witnessed things in her house. Okay, we go back. It's still really hot. Summer 74.
Mm.
And we go there, and we're in the kitchen talking to Doris, my colleague and I. And suddenly, one of the lowered cupboard doors swings open, and an iron skillet goes flying out a couple of feet and drops to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So we checked to see if there were children in there, or animals, or wires, or springs, or something that could have physically propelled the skillet, and there was not.
Yeah.
It evolved from that into weird lights in her house from no apparent source. So we got to the point where we sealed off the bedroom area that was the focal point of the lights.
Mm.
And even in this pitch dark environment, you could see the lights. They were extraordinary. We tried to take pictures, nothing happened. Now, this is a very difficult case because it's more of a psychodynamic one than of a paranormal one per se.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is, Doris claimed there were three entities that attacked her.
Yeah.
Two smaller ones and one bigger one that would actually rape her. Now, in her real life, she had four children. A very young little girl we never saw, which was good.
Mm.
Because, you know, I wouldn't want her around this stuff anyway.
Yeah.
She had three boys, two smaller ones and one much bigger one, yeah, older one.
Yeah.
And she had a very unusual sort of psychosexual attitude. She used to walk around the house naked, and who knows what was going on between her and her kids. It might have been some Oedipal thing transpiring. But it's intriguing from a psychoanalytic perspective to understand that three entities, two smaller males and one bigger male, would attack her. It sounds like her boys.
Yeah.
And I'll go into more detail, but I have the strongest feeling that this is more of a poltergeist case versus a haunting. And the reason I say this is that over time, the phenomena moves with Doris as she moved to places. So at one point, we're in her bedroom. It was really hot. Everyone's perspiring. And we covered the walls and ceiling with black poster boards and duct tape. We made like a checkerboard pattern, because we did get one picture in one of the attempts trying to make something happen.
Yeah.
And all you saw was a ball of light with a tail on it. That's it. So there was no reference. Where is it coming from? Where is it going to? What's the speed it's traveling at? What's the size of it? At one point, lights start occurring in the bedroom. There's about 20 of us in there. And the lights go before that. It's right, flying around Doris. And they're arcing over her, they're spinning around her. So we had several professional photographers there who were taking photos, different cameras, different speeds, different films, near infrared lighting and from the flash bulbs from the camera. And one of the pictures on my website, and it's all over the place, you see Doris on her bed, and there's an arc over her head framing her. And what's important about this arc is, if you look behind the arc, there are two walls that connect in a completely 90 degree angles to each other. There's a wall bent there because two walls intersect.
Yeah.
If this was a projected light source through a fraudulent mechanism, it would be on the wall and be bent in the corners of the perpendicular walls. That was not the case, which suggests this light was in space. So while we couldn't get the individual lights, we got like a track, and this is more indicative if you take a picture of stars at night, a time exposure, but your platform isn't moving, you get streaks, because the sky is, sky moves as the earth moves.
Yeah.
So, anyway, another picture, which is on my website in my book, Doris, not even in the frame, it's the same bedroom, and two arcs, one going from top to top, one from bottom to bottom. We never saw it. Now, these two pictures were analyzed by the West Coast editor of popular photography back then named Adrian Vance. And he said he looked at the cameras and looked at the original, the negatives, and he said, I have no idea what these are. He'd never seen anything like this. Now, this is where it gets really interesting with this man. In high school, I was like a mad scientist. And I was borrowing some chemicals to make my own rocket fuel.
As you do.
And you weren't allowed to own these because they're volatile as hell. Didn't want to blow anything up. I just wanted to make better rocket fuel.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was caught borrowing of a jar of potassium chlorate. And I didn't get it, blah, blah. Okay, so I got in a lot of trouble. I didn't get kicked out of school, but I was warned, don't do this again. Okay, I found other sources for the oxidizer a little later. But anyway, and then, not long after that, in chemistry, this is what the man was teaching. I ended up making a glass of nitroglycerin. it wasn't good. Anyway, so okay. Come back. We're now in the lab. The lab's up and running.
Yeah.
And I remember in the lab one day, Dr. Moss calls up from her office, which was on the lower floor. And she says, oh, Barry, come on down to my office. Someone here wants to talk to you. Okay. So I get in the elevator. I go down to the bottom floor. I go to her office. And there is Adrian Vance. I went, oh, my God, what's this? So he was really into the paranormal. And that's how we met him. And they ended up analyzing our photos from the entity case.
Yeah.
And you know, if you look at the entity case as a whole, it seems to be more of a libidinous fantasy, a projection from her own mind. Now, it's important to understand, and it's on my website and it'll be in my new book, that long before Doris Beither and her children lived on Braddock Drive in Culver City, there was phenomena happening to her in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
Okay. Then she moved to Culver City. We were there. Then she moved from there, finally. The place was like, it really bad. It had been condemned twice by the city.
Mm.
But she moved from Culver City to Carson. We found her, went out to see her, and things were happening, not at the same level, but a potentially intense level.
Mm.
We're sitting in her living room, and suddenly a big vase goes flying through the air, misses all of us, and slams into the floor.
Mm.
Then she ended up moving from there to, what, Riverside or San Bernardino, and it followed her there. We didn't, but Frank DiFelita did. Now,
yes. What
happened, Frank DiFelita met her and interviewed her at great length, and she was more open to him about what was going on than she was to my colleague and I, because he was closer to her parents' age, I guess. And so he wrote the book, The Entity. It became a national bestseller, and then he wrote a screenplay, and it was made into a movie. And what happened was, Frank was supposed to direct the movie.
Yes.
At the very last minute, they decided to take him away and replace him with Sid Fury.
Mm.
And he thought we were all crazy. Sid Fury, he didn't believe in anything we said. He thought we were all a bunch of lunatics. We were drugged. Thought we were druggies.
Right.
So he dramatically rewrote Frank's script, and in my opinion, he dramatically weakened it at every turn.
Yeah.
It was some good photography in there. I thought Barbara Hershey did a damn good job,
as
did Ron Silver. I was interested in that Barbara Hershey pleaded to be in the movie, as did Ron Silver. They begged Frank to be in it.
Mm.
Okay, he hired them. And then after the film came out, they said it was the biggest mistake of their lives. Because the film was looked at as very misogynistic.
Mm.
It was anti-feminine. It was whatever, all the wrong reasons.
Yes.
And when Frank DiFelita was interviewed by the LA Times about it, I forgot what he said. It's locked away in some files I have. What he said, he made some off-the-wall comments which didn't make him sound like the greatest person on earth in terms of understanding what Doris went through.
Yeah.
It was more of like, I'm going to make money from this. I'll write a novel and make him write a script and make a movie. But that's what the industry is.
Yeah.
Now, what's important to understand, the phenomena move with Doris, which is again indicative of a poltergeist case.
Mm.
My guess would be that if we had run her up medically, neurologically speaking, we would have found that she was either seizure prone or epileptic.
Yeah.
See, what a surprise.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, absolutely amazing.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, because I think the thing about the entity case, Barry, is that a lot of people's understanding of that particular case seems to be based on the film. And as far as I'm aware, there's a few minor points that actually happened, but the majority of that film is entirely a work of fiction, isn't it?
Right, right. Now, the film, the movie, the script was based on Frank's novel, which was a novel. It wasn't a documentary.
Yes.
It should be clear, made clear right up front, that we did not build a environment for Doris of her old home in the middle of a school where they would know, like a basketball court. No, we didn't build that. No, that was fantasy. When Frank DiFelita was writing the book, he said, if you had druthers, what would you do? I said, well, simple. Bring the case into a lab. Take it into a controlled environment.
Mm. You
know, where we can monitor what's going on in many levels. And, okay. And so that's what he did, and in the novel he spoke of us using thermal imaging, holographic laser cameras, all sorts of things, and you know, that's what we would have used had there been money and an open willingness on the part of the university to allow this work to go on. I should say up front that the UCLA did not in any way condone what we were doing. In fact, they hated it. We started showing up on shows like INLA twice, two on the town, the LA Times over and over again, the Herald Examiner, all these. They were going nuts because they didn't want the public to think they condoned this work, which they did not. But the movie was based on the novel. The novel was a novel. So there was no, in real life, there was no psychiatrist like Ron Silver. However, in real life, when they were shooting the film, one of the actors, I think David LaBiosa, he was pulled back as if the enemy moved through him, and I think he broke his arm, which, in the movie, it's just things happen. I don't believe that anything paranormal happened during the course of the filming. One time it was really hot. We were shooting it at the Culver Studios in 1981, and so we had some tanks of liquid nitrogen. We were going to produce certain effects based on what the book was about. And I said, hey guys, just vent the tanks. They go, what? Vent them? It's inert. It's not corrosive. It's not explosive. It'll cool the place down, and it cooled everything down. The movie, if you want to know the truth, buy my book, Aliens Above, Ghosts Below, and you can read the article called, I think it's Chapter 2, or The Real Entity Case.
Yeah.
And that goes through it. I'll have a bigger, longer version of this in the new book I'm writing now. What's important for people to understand is, when you look at these cases, you have to look at them in a very large, I guess, in a gestalt manner, that it's not simply what the people say. You have to say, what do they claim is happening? What's their medical background? What's their psychological background? What's the psychodynamic of the families in this situation? You know, over and over again. And it's, like I said, 10-1 that she was seizure, that Doris was either seizure prone or epileptic. But we'll never know, because she barely, probably 70% of the questions I asked her, she refused to even respond to.
It's almost as if they're caught in a perfect storm, where the environment as well, because I know she, the houses that she lived in were not in the best condition. She'd had a very unusual, because I believe all her children had separate fathers.
Correct. Every child was from a different man. Yeah, she didn't have a good background. Somewhat of a dysfunctional family environment. Abused by her uncle or something like that. But see, that's part of the picture. Her claims of being sexually assaulted, we could not prove or disprove. We weren't there when they happened. But I'll tell you one thing that did happen, and I should have mentioned this, and this is the most dramatic. So at one point, we're in the bedroom, and the lights we saw were always lime green in color, always lime green. They were swimming around, and at one point, they coalesced to the corner, and there was a large male apparition. Well over 6 feet, maybe 6'6", 6'7", huge. The head, the neck, the pectoral, the shoulders, the biceps going down and through the abdomen, abdominal region, and it stopped. Lime green in color, and it was not a static image. It was articulating. It moved as it was looking at it, and suddenly, pop, it was gone. We fired off hundreds of frames of film. Nothing showed up. Now, there is such thing as mass hysteria, but there is not a mass hallucination. So everyone wrote down what they saw. We all saw the same thing. So what is it that we saw that a camera could not photograph? We don't know. So it's the whole, is it nowadays we would be very different in how we'd look at this. That was the most, that was a pretty amazing case, however anyone looks at it.
I mean, it is. I think, like I say, it's one of those cases, Barry, where the notoriety of the film, because I remember as a young person, it was a film everybody had to see, and it was only sort of 10 years later that I kind of got my head around the fact that most of that was just cinematic license, I think is the nicest way you can describe it.
Yeah, dramatic license. It's a movie. It's not reality.
True.
It's like when opening night of The Exorcist, October 1973, I took my girlfriend to see it, and I already had met Blatty and Friedkin. They came to the lab, and the story's in my book. So But we're watching the movie. It's the first act. Linda Blair is being bounced around on the bed before it gets really violent. And I turned to my girlfriend in this dead quiet theater in Westwood. I said, oh, I've seen a bed do that in a house in Hollywood. And my girlfriend went, what? And then a voice booms out from much further away in the theater. Hey, Barry, is that you? My girlfriend goes, what is this? He was a professor of mine from UCLA, a friend of mine. He said, you're the only person on earth that could make that statement. It was you. So, you know, and then my girlfriend was so upset by the movie, she couldn't sleep. I go, yeah, it's a movie. What? Get over it. It's a movie.
Yeah.
Just get over it. It's nothing but a movie.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was an incredible case. Mm. But I wish we had had the instruments we have today to measure the environment and to measure her. Because we've discovered, for example, that we have like a magnetometer, which are far too insensitive to measure a body's magnetic field, which is really weak. But if you get them near a poltergeist agent, someone who's the generator or a trigger the phenomena, their bodies are putting out such a strong electromagnetic field that we can measure them.
Yeah.
But you put them next to someone normal, nothing. Put them next to it and they say, oh, look, gee, what a strange coincidence. It's the people's biomagnetic field coupling with the environment that triggers this stuff.
Yeah.
And they said, nowadays we've got the technologies, but unfortunately, the last case I had was some years ago, because people want to be on TV versus having scientists come out and investigate their case.
Yeah, I mean, that is a frustration of the modern phenomenon. But before I interrupted you, I believe you were going to mention probably one of my favorite poltergeist cases, primarily, Barry, if it's the one I'm thinking about, because of the incident involving a cabbage. If it's Holly Mont.
Yes, Holly Mont was 1976. You can find a lengthy article on my website called The Holly Mont Haunting, As Good As It Gets. And literally, it was. Holly Mont Drive, 6221 Holly Mont Drive in Hollywood. This guy Mark comes to the lab back in 76. There's a party and things are flying around. That's what he said. So we go up to the house a few days later, another party. We're in there, and objects were thrown at us. A woman earlier, before we were there, our previous party, was pinned against the wall by a thrown chair, and a big kettle of water came off the stove and dumped its contents onto her hair, onto her head. While we were there, amazing things happened. A fire broke out in the upstairs bathroom.
Yeah.
From what? A fire in the bathroom?
Yeah.
Okay. I made a glass of iced tea. I turned away to get some lemon to put in it. I turned back. The tea's gone. Where is it? It was three rooms away through two locked doors. It was amazing. One point, a shower head came flying down the stairwell, following its curved path, to drop at our feet.
Mm.
Another time in the foyer, we're there, and then it was at night. The lights go off, they come on, and a second later, there was a thick black, I guess, curtain or wrapped around the chandelier. In order to do that, you would have had to get up on a very strong stepladder to put it up there, but there was no stepladder, and it was instantaneous. It was, at one point, a news crew was there from the old KTTV before it was called Fox.
Mm.
And a news crew, a woman named Connie Fox, and things were happening to her and her crew, and she started to freak out. So she ran out of the house with the photographers, and as they went out, a book comes flying over the home, flapping its pages like a bird, and makes three distinct 90-degree turns, following the stairwell, and drops at the woman's feet. She's screaming her lungs out.
I mean, in regards to the other cases, what was the environment like? Because I believe the house was owned by a gentleman who was actually a banker, so he was quite a well-to-do chap in comparison.
Don Jolly. was his name. Now, this is what gets really interesting about the environment. The environment, first thing, was that it was sitting on the intersection of two active earthquake faults.
Mm.
What a coincidence. Also, there's a shallow river under the house.
Yeah.
What? Well, that's hydrodynamic forces.
Mm.
Hydromagnetic forces. And then there's a body buried when the neighbor, Dexter Gray, the house just to the east of the one on 6221, we're talking to him, and he said he was renovating the house years earlier, and he was leaning against a shelving unit built into the wall, and it opened up through a secret passageway. It pivoted, and he went in down there with his girlfriend and a neighbor, and they walked through the dark corridor or tunnels under the home. They used to run liquor during Prohibition, I guess.
Yeah.
And he's walking there with a flashlight. They found a makeshift grave and a headstone, a woman named Regina from 1922.
Oh.
What?
Goodness.
Someone buried a woman there in 1922? Never been exhumed, as far as we know.
Oh.
Now, there have been so many earthquakes since that time, and the river's gotten really intense. I would suspect that the casket and the body have been washed away, but we don't know. There's never been enough. The house is in really bad condition and a lot of water erosion. Mm. It was renovated, and the interior is ghastly. It's really bad work they did it. You don't know what it is. It's a combination of old, 1920s, 30s stuff and modern. It looks hellacious. But we were last time we were there was in 2008.
Mm.
We spent about 6-7 hours there. A couple of things happened. Nothing like, oh my God, like it was in the 70s. But of course, we're a lot older.
Yeah.
So that might be the case. But what's interesting, so I'm packing up my gear in this one Pelican case. I pick up the case, and there's something carved in the bottom. Now, Pelican cases are very hard. They're very durable, very strong.
Mm.
And to carve this, you'd need a chisel and a hammer, which we would have heard.
Yeah.
I pick it up and go, what? It's a lazy R, the backwards R.
Mm.
Well, the woman buried under the house is named Regina. it's amazing the things that happened there.
Yeah.
It was truly a news crew was there. At one point, we were in the pantry between the dining room and the kitchen, and suddenly we're being pelted by coins falling, and we looked up, it was raining pennies. Hundreds, right? Thousands of pennies.
Yeah.
Just fall way back because it hurt. We backed it. It filled the floor maybe, I don't know, half inch, 2 inch deep.
Wow.
And when there was no source. So where's the pennies coming from?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the stranger it gets, and we were there also in 76, the street lamp in front of this house would go off and on during the day, but the other street lamps would not.
Mm.
So this is a pretty, a dramatic setting.
Yeah.
And and the place has been turned over. So many different people have lived there. When I wrote the article on my website years ago, I got some guy never knew who did live there. He was a producer. He chimed in a letter. This conversation is in the article on my website and will be in my new book.
Mm.
And he had stuff happening there. And then five and a half years ago, I was being interviewed at UCLA. They did a short thing called Haunted UCLA. And the girl that interviewed me, forgot her name, her and her boyfriend were up there years earlier, and according to what she said, they were filming, a video camera, and suddenly his clothes burst into flame. Big licks of blue-green flame, and everyone's panicking, and he was, so I tried calling him, but he didn't want to get involved with stuff. He says it was her ex-boyfriend. He didn't want to be involved, but she could be lying.
Yeah.
And spontaneous combustion is nothing to joke about.
No, very true. Yeah. I mean, is it? Because, like I say, I know when I touched on when we were just about to start talking about it, this incident with the cabbage, because I believe Don had someone he had that worked in
houseboy.
Yeah.
Houseboy. And at one point, a large cabbage with a big, sharp butcher's knife in it was flying around the house chasing the boy that was working there.
God.
The houseboy.
I'm amazed he lasted as long as he did, because I know he kept saying he was going to quit until something finally happened, and he just went, no, that's it, I'm done.
I mean, Don sort of accepted this, and he was very gracious of him to let us stay there when the house was in escrow in 1976, which gave us a unique opportunity. There were just so many, like I said, the case is broken down in many ways on my website. It'll be in my new book. And of all the cases I've ever worked on, this is the one you could sit back and just wait. Things would happen. Like, I'd already go again and again and again and again. And, you know, it would have been, and the house has been, I don't know, I assume someone's living in it now.
Yeah, good luck to
them. I wish them luck. I don't think I'd want to live in it only because the way it was decorated, renovated, it looks horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, either keep it in the era it was made in or make it completely modern, but the mixture of it, it looks really cheap, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
Kid did it.
I mean, it is one of those cases that when you read about it, it's such a variety of phenomenon as well, Barry. You know what I mean? Because I think, that also the incident where you... Did you have some bananas thrown at you as well?
Yeah, with a phone was thrown at us, some bananas were thrown at us. In the kitchen, it was just, it was one thing, it was so many things, I couldn't keep track of them all. It's in my, it's on my website, it's in my book. And it wasn't harm. At one point, a glass jar was thrown at us. And a phone was thrown at us. And one morning I was talking on the phone, we were living there, and suddenly I hear a pop. I see the phone jack that goes into the wall was violently yanked out of the wall, and the cord was being pulled away from me, and then it dropped. It's the place is amazing. And like I said, it's a perfect environment. You got the geomagnetic forces, you got hydromagnetic forces, all that comes into play. And the area, though, is very unsafe to begin with. It's the nearest two major cross streets in Hollywood are Franklin and Argyle. Mm. And we were there, you know, we were living there for like 10 days back in 1976. And every night we heard gunfire down below. More gunfire, more gunfire. And we saw the flashes of gunfire. There's a lot of drug traffic in the area, high crime rates, helicopters every night. But again, I used to live on the edge of Beverly Hills in L.A., and there were helicopters almost every other night anyway, so it doesn't matter. But that part of Hollywood is kind of seedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a really dubious reputation. And we were only living there for the sake of what we would learn, and we learned a lot. But like I said, each case gave us more information. And 2008 was great. At one point upstairs, one of my colleagues, Barry Conrad, was taking a picture in the shower stall, which didn't even work. And instead of having just a picture, he's perfect five-color rainbow was, you see it arcing across in the air.
Yeah.
But he never saw that. It was amazing. It was truly amazing, thing we had happening there. One point we're upstairs, another colleague of mine, Jack Rourke, was with us, and Lori Jacobson showed up, who wrote the book Hollywood Haunted.
Yes.
She showed up. We invited her as well. And suddenly the chandelier in this little tiny, like a room you pray in or something, that he didn't use it for that anymore, the chandelier just starts swinging back and forth for no reason. it was amazing. The place, like I said, it's still there. It's been renovated. You know, it's interesting. You read stories about when haunted places are remodeled or upgraded.
Yeah.
That the phenomena tends to go crazy, and people would think, well, the ghosts don't like it. And it may have more to do with the fact that the relationship of conductors to dielectrics in the house may have more to do with how why the phenomena reacts when you modify a house.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was an amazing case. And it'd be great to go back. In fact, we were supposed to go back. There was another show. Mm-hmm. But the people that were managing the house lied to us about they already had flipped it. They already sold it. And another group. It was just a game. Look, if you want us to come out, contact these people. We're not going to waste our time with you. Mm-hmm. They were playing games. But the house was an extraordinary location for many reasons. And at least the house didn't make me sick. So one of my cases made me deathly ill.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this stuff is amazing. And you know, the more we learn, and see, here's the thing. if you took thousands of people to the most haunted locations on Earth, what would happen? Okay, most people would go in, they hear stories, they read about it, and they leave. Nothing would happen.
Yeah.
One in maybe 100,000, one in maybe a million would walk in there, and their presence would trigger events. And if we knew, we'd understand, oh, they're epileptic, they're seizure prone, they have a high susceptibility, they're ultra-sensitive to electromagnetic fields, and they have their coping mechanism for stress is very low. Hmm. If all those things work in concert, wow, things start happening.
Yeah, very true. I mean, had Don done the renovations, Barry, that had caused it? Or had this house got a reputation prior to him moving in?
All that we know is that there were, I think, one suicide up there and two murders. But as far as owners prior to Don Jolly, we couldn't unearth anything that was relevant.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, like you say, it's probably the perfect set of ingredients, because I've often found it interesting that, you know, as you say, you know, thousands of people can go through a haunted location and not see anything, but that one particular person will be at that one particular time and has an experience. And that's always interested me, that clearly that shows that not everybody has the right ability to conduct or receive this kind of...
Yeah, they're the term I use in my book. I call them biological operational amplifiers.
Yeah,
their bodies act on the environment, and it's a bound and rebound. Their body helps to trigger and focus what's there.
Yeah, very true.
And so the thing is, we know enough now after all these cases that it's a question. What case I knew about recently, I was talking to the woman involved and asking her questions. Yeah, okay, this is, and finally get to the medical stuff. Oh, she's epileptic again. It's the same thing, I'm telling you, over and over. My favorite food on earth is lobster. I love lobster. As much as I love it, I wouldn't want it for dinner every day.
Yes.
You get bored. I don't care how good it tastes. Even or steak or whatever. And I love shrimp. You don't want it every day. The running into this linked epilepsy and seizures has gotten boring because it's the same thing every time. Mm. The faces and places may change. The phenomena does not.
Yeah.
And now, given what we know, we theoretically could artificially trigger these events, but it would run the risk of severely hurting, if not killing, people in the environment. Yeah. So we're not going to do that.
Yeah, very much so. I think there's one other case that I'd like to mention as well, if that's all right, Barry.
Sure.
Which is also very famous. Now, this one, I think, is probably most famous, once again, because as you mentioned about the Doris Byers case, there is the famous arc light picture. The San Pedro case is infamous because of the picture of, I believe, is it Jeff Wheatcroft, who ended up with the noose around his neck in the attic. But that case seems quite similar to the entity case, but yet it seems a little bit more different as well, that Jackie seemed a bit more stable in comparison, I suspect.
1989, you had a call from a woman named last name is Cust. Come out, her friend is having a place is haunted. So Barry Conrad, myself, and Jeff Wheatcroft, for the most part, go out to this house in San Pedro on 11th Street, and a little bungalow in the back. It's not the primary home. And, you know, terrible smell, like the entity case. very hot, humid night again. Jackie was a very interesting lady. She was like wired, very emotionally fragmented, fragile. She went through a horrible marriage, and she was now separated, and she had two kids to care for on her own, trying to make a living and get more education, and so she was going through hell.
Yeah.
And so we were there, and at one point, we saw strange lights, and luckily my colleague at the time was a man named Barry Conrad, and he was fortunate enough to capture some of these odd lights flying around that we caught with our eyes. But the focus on where it gets really intense, now Jackie told us that at one point she entered the kid's bedroom. She saw a man sitting on a lower bed. It was like bunk beds. And she said, like old, he had a plaid shirt on, really short pants, like from the 50s, suddenly working at a gas station.
Yeah.
And looked at very evil, scared the hell out of her. And other times, like objects were thrown at her, like cans of Coca-Cola or silverware, things like weird liquids dripping from the walls. So we, at one point, we're there, and it sounded like there was a 200-pound rat in the attic bouncing around.
Yeah.
So we go up there, not much happening, and then about sometime later on another date, Barry's there with Jeff, and my father suffered a heart attack, so I had to help my mom. They were there, and suddenly Barry comes down. It was Jeff Wheatcraft and Gary Bain were up there, and all of a sudden Gary hears like a scream, and he turns, and he couldn't see, so he fired the camera to see what was there, and he sees this clothesline wrapped in a bowline knot around Jeff's neck, and it's picking him up, one of the heavy nails in the rafters. There's nothing there. But it, so he got him down. Had Gary Bain not been there, Jeff very likely would have died.
Yeah.
And Barry would have been accused as murder. Yeah. I could just see it now, trying to prosecute a case. Stand up. How do you defend this sort of thing? You can't. So, but anyway, the case went on.
Yeah.
And over and over, things would happen. Now, with the, it went on beyond that, because things started happening at Barry's apartment. Jackie came to visit Barry a few times when he lived in Studio City, and while she, when she moved out, phenomena would happen in Barry's apartment. Glasses flying through it, scissors coming through his pillow when he was sleeping, the stove turning its burners on its own accord. It was amazing. And it's all related to Jackie. And she eventually moved up north to, forgot the area, about 300 miles north of L.A. And Barry and Jeff went up there. I couldn't accompany them because my mom needed my help with my dad. Things started happening. Objects flying around, banging noises, the sofa bouncing up and down. Barry caught some more luminous anomalies flying around. It was amazing. Now, what's important is that this case is so extraordinary because of the following. Jackie really was attracted to Barry Conrad.
Yeah.
You know, he looked like a young Elvis. Tall, black hair, blue eyes, very affable, friendly. You know, women loved him.
Yeah.
Constantly. And she was attracted to Barry, but she discovered that Jeff was always around. And to her, Jeff was an impediment to her growing closer to Barry. So she wanted Jeff out of the way. Who did the phenomena focus on repeatedly trying to hurt or kill? Jeff.
Yeah.
What a coincidence. And I said to her, some show we were on, Barry wasn't available, he was out of town shooting some show. Yeah, so I explained this to the producer. She went like, what? Oh, so you mean Jackie's telling the ghost what to do, and the ghost is doing, and I go, it's not Jack, it's not a ghost, it's Jackie. What? The things that happened were extraordinary, where they were, up in Northern California, and they're having a little seance, Barry and Jackie and Jeff, and Jeff is thrown up, picked up from his chair, the chair drops down, he arcs up several feet in the air, slams into the wall where it meets the ceiling, and he hits the floor, he's unconscious.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And who did Jackie hate? Jeff. What a surprise. Now, this is really important. Mm. So, Jackie moves from her little bungalow in San Pedro.
Yeah.
And the phenomenon follows her. It's with her.
Yes.
Meanwhile, new people move into the bungalow, knowing nothing about Jackie's being a prior tenant, and they start experiencing similar phenomena to what Jackie did. But wait a minute. Jackie is gone, and the phenomenon is still with her.
Yeah.
So what's going on here? Well, it's sort of what I call the psychovirus. Look at it this way. Let's say you're really healthy.
Mm.
You go over to a friend's house. The kids are sick. You stay away from the kids. You visit your friends. You don't shake hands. You don't give them a hug, nothing. You show up, blah, blah, blah. You leave. You then get sick. You give it to your family. That's a vectored pathogen. We understand that.
Mm.
This sounds the same, except it's not biologic, it's energetic.
Mm.
That some people, this alters us. It alters perhaps your nervous system, and it resonates, so I call that inductive resonance coupling. You then be the propagator of it.
Yeah.
And so it was carried with you, but meanwhile, new people come in the environment, and it affects them as well.
Yeah.
But not all the people.
Mm.
And there are studies that could be done to demonstrate this as valid theory or model, except doctors who did it, medical doctors, would never work again if they got involved with it.
Yes.
They'd never be able to practice medicine. It'd be the death of their career.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it often leads to that term, because I've often heard people, Barry, as though people are haunted rather than a property, whereas this is clearly saying that the person is the focus and is generating the energy to create these experiences to anything around them.
Well, I think they're generating it. I think they're tapping in what's already there.
Mm.
If we were generating it, it would fry a person. The
yes.
Strong magnetic fields we've measured around these individuals. If this was their energy, it would be literally, they'd be immolating. It's like spontaneous human combustion. It's something about their body is tapping into what's around them, and then able to focus it.
Mm.
There was a case, oh, it's in my book, of a girl I met teaching in the mid-80s. And really beautiful young girl, almost half my age. And long story short, she was epileptic.
Mm.
And things would fly around her. She'd walk by cars. The alarms would go off. I was interviewing her, and suddenly the top of my pen takes off and flies across the room.
Mm.
I'm interviewing her on a tape, and suddenly a voice comes on it that doesn't belong there, and it's laughing hysterically.
Mm.
You know, and I told her, look, as you mature, this might go away, but, you know, she didn't want to, well, she's epileptic, so we knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And, but see, with me being sensitive to this, and people, maybe that's why I felt sick in Jackie's house. Maybe she was epileptic, or seizure prone, I should say, not epileptic. But a lot of people might be epileptic, but they never get kindled to the point of having a seizure.
Yeah.
It means that they have that potential, but it's never happened yet.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
And so, yeah, this is, like I said, this is, to my knowledge, the only physiological correlate to the paranormal. And it's so consistent, like I said, it's again and again, we know. On a case in Covina, in 2008, I believe, I was there with Barry Conrad, nice lady. Long story short, they move into a fixer-upper, her husband and her kid. They redo the house. It's quite attractive, beautiful. And suddenly her husband goes crazy and tries to kill her. They arrest him, put him in jail. They keep him in a facility for a while, let him loose. They don't know what happened. So then he comes home, everything's fine. Suddenly, out of the blue, he pulls out a new gun and blows his head off in the dining room.
Oh.
And it was later she discovered that the prior owner of the house, before they even saw it, had killed himself by the same way, with the same method, at the same location in the house.
God.
And then phenomena before that and afterwards. Luminous anomaly, disembodied voices, object movements, banging noises on the walls, the floors. And so she's done telling us this. She had a young daughter, but, well, it was a teenage daughter, but she wasn't there while we were there. She said, Oh, yeah, something else happened. I wonder if it's relevant. What? Does being epileptic have any relevance? Yep, here we go again. And it's amazing. Like you said, if these odds were relevant in Vegas, I'd be a billionaire.
Yeah, absolutely.
You just keep going there and going there. And you keep winning. Oh, same thing over. Oh, I won $500,000 tonight. I won $2 million. Yeah, you could bet on it. And sometimes it's so subtle, you're not aware of it. Like the person may have trouble sleeping, and it's because of neuromuscular spasms in their arms, their legs. Hmm. And they give them different medications to quell that. When they take the medication, not only do the seizures go away, but the phenomenon stops.
Yeah.
And so, now, what are we to make of this? Well, it means that we don't end with the tip of our toes or our nose. We extend far beyond that into the environment. We can access the past, the present, and the future. But imagine, here's the whole bottom line. Well, this is where it comes to the base of all this, the essence of it. In the case of Jeff being picked up and thrown into the wall, 212-pound, 6-foot-2 man, picked up like a rag doll, thrown in the wall. The energies we know of in the universe, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear gravity, before they would be present in sufficient intensity to move him that way, the room, the furnishings, and his clothing would burst into flame because of the liberated energy, the second law of thermodynamics. Yeah. Not only does it not get hot in the environment, it usually gets cool, which means whatever the energy is, it's not exothermic, it's endothermic.
Yeah.
And there's no other energy we know of that does this anywhere. I mean, energy moving, if you move to pick up a glass or walk to the fridge or you walk down the stairs, your body's producing more heat because you're moving versus sitting still. But this stuff's doing all this work, the phenomena, yet there's no heat. If we found out what this is, it could take us to the stars. This might be zero-point energy. I have a feeling that's what it is.
I mean, it is interesting as well because, you know, there are numerous examples in poltergeist cases, Barry, where, especially when it comes to a porch, when people pick things up, they feel warm to the touch. And yet, as you've often referred to, certain areas will suddenly, there'll be a massive temperature drop, or things will happen in a cold environment, whereas, as you say, under the normal laws of thermodynamics, that's impossible.
Right. I mean, in order, think about Jeff being picked up and thrown to the wall. If you could do the math on that, which I can't do at this moment, but if you did, you'd find out the energy would should have set his clothes on fire, and the rug on fire, and the walls on fire, and the furniture. But that's not what happened. So that means we're something in the universe is telling us something by this demonstration. What are we to do about it? Oh, well, it's just a ghost, or it's a poltergeist. It's energy of a unique source that could change the course of human history. We don't need geothermal energy. We wouldn't need hydroelectric. We don't need nuclear. This is energy that might be ubiquitous.
Yeah.
We tap it, everything changes forever. So that's what it comes down to, that this stuff is extraordinary. Something is demonstrating itself to us over and over again. And because we don't understand it, and there's such fear and dogma linked into the skepticism of it, it inhibits better and deeper investigation, which is the problem.
I mean, you touched on that right at the very beginning when we were talking about this, because I think one of the frustrations, especially for somebody like myself, Barry, who's been a big fan of the way you worked and the scientific methods that you and your colleagues brought into it, these days I think most people say, oh well, there's no famous poltergeist cases, no, you know, there's nothing going on like the Sally House or San Pedro or anything like that. Do you think that the modern investigation these days has progressed to being all about demons and fear and being on television rather than a rigorous scientific investigation to actually get to the root of these situations?
Yes, I think the various paranormal, what I call unreality shows, have done a great deal disservice to the field. In my personal professional opinion, it set the field back by maybe 85 years or more. If you look up the real history of the word demon, you discover it has nothing to do with monsters or creatures that are going to get you or entities. The word demon is from, if you look at it, as history tells us, those who did not follow the teachings of the church were demonized by the church. But they were not following the work of teaching and the word of God. They were demonized. That's where the word comes from. Nothing about monsters or entities or creatures or devils or that. It's that simple. So now we've twisted into that. And now, here's another part of the problem, that we've had cases that have begun as poltergeist cases and evolved into a UFO abduction, or began as an abduction or CE3 and evolved into a poltergeist situation, which suggests that the energies used in both might be very similar.
Yeah.
But what in the end result is, but now we're seeing a dumbing down from science. And the bottom line with all this, Paul, is this. The general public doesn't have a need to know a lot of science, because that's not why we're alive.
Yeah.
If you ask person, the average person, why the sky is blue, they won't know.
Yeah.
They ask the average person, but the primary gas in our atmosphere is, they won't know.
Mm.
They don't have a need to know. What do they have? And who cares? But see, most, if you don't know how the physical world you've lived in, existed in, since the beginning of your existence, works, and how can you speculate as to what exists beyond its boundaries?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, one of the reasons, the primary reason why our government stopped remote viewing research decades ago was because they were Bible thumpers in our government, elected officials. It's the devil's work. It's demonic. It's the devil's work. Oh, please. It's, come on. And then if you look back to the beginning of our own Air Force investigating UFOs in actually the late 30s and then the 40s during the Second World War, you discovered that our government, the people were terrified because they thought that it was that UFOs was a battle between God and the devil in the air.
Mm.
What? This is the middle of the 20th century then. What are they thinking about?
Yeah.
They're crazy. It's like you don't deal with that. You ignore people like that because it gets you nowhere.
Mm.
Science and religion are light years apart.
Yeah.
But eventually they may merge in some future era where people, I mean, you realize that all the phenomena and the weird phenomena described in the Bible we call paranormal, the same thing people have today, but they just called it something different.
Yeah.
It's, I just got this weird feeling that if once the stuff is fully understood in terms of the paranormal, it's going to make people feel very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because they're going to know more about the real world they live in than they ever expected to.
Yeah, or maybe even wanted to.
Right, exactly that. We found in our psi training groups, it wasn't really hard to get people to increase their psychic potential.
Hmm.
Some people, not everyone responded well. But of those who did respond well, they all had problems coping with it, the emotional trauma, the trauma of it, the unexpected occurrences, and people would rat. It's like giving a blind man sight for the first time. It's overwhelming. Oh my God, look what's there. Look at the world.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at. And I just, it's amazing. I'm working on this new book. I can't give you the title, but it's going to cover more of my research, more cases, more things that have happened. And one of the strangest things, back in 1963, there was an episode of The Twilight Zone, an hour episode, called Death Ship.
Yes.
Starring Ross Martin and Jack Klugman, written by Richard Matheson.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so impressed with that, I wanted to meet the writer. I was what, 14 years old. How am I going to meet the writer? I'm a kid. So, 10 years later, I'm in the lab, 1973. Who walks in? Richard Matheson and his son, Richard Christian Matheson. They came to me, and we became friends, and I worked with them for a while. I've known the son since then. We've become good friends.
Mm.
And on my website, there's an article called Very, Very Personal and Enduring Synchronicities.
Mm.
And these weird linkages between Richard Christian Matheson and I are extraordinary. extraordinary.
Yes.
And it's almost like it's spooky. It's extremely spooky. Yeah. We have the same birthday, month, day, and time, but he's 4 years younger than me. But the parallels, the synchronicities are just mind-boggling. I don't know what they mean. They're just there.
Yeah.
And,
that's strange.
No, but it's, I mean, yeah, I don't want to even get into it because the article tells a better story than I could speak of.
Yeah. I'll tell you something that may surprise you. The the episode that precedes this one is about the Twilight Zone.
Oh, interesting.
and we mentioned Richard Matheson in that one.
Yeah, he wrote 14 episodes of the series.
Two of the most famous stories were obviously one of the William Shatner ones is one of the most famous ones which he wrote. So, it's quite interesting that you mentioned that, and that's my preceding episode to this one.
Interesting. Yeah, the Twilight Zone, when I was growing up, the Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, The Invaders, Star Trek, they were what I really loved watching.
Mm-hmm.
It's and more than anything else, they all helped one maybe want to become a writer.
Mm.
Because, you know, you write about what you see and experience.
Yeah.
And Richard, it was such a pleasure and a privilege meeting both him, Richard, and his son. It shows you the extreme synchronicities. So my mother passed away 11 years ago, and Richard knew I had parents, but he never really knew their names. So after my mom passed away, I was telling him about it on the phone, and he said, "What was your mother's name?" And I said, "Ruth." He went, "Are you kidding?" I go, "Why would I lie about that? What do you mean? My mother's name is Ruth." "What?" Huh. I hadn't seen Richard in a long time. He was busy.
Yeah.
We reconnected in 2005, and I used to have a Rolex watch. It was a piece of junk. Watches never run on me very well, so I sold it. So I wanted to get a watch, a particular watch called a Tag Heuer Curium. They were very, very expensive, but I hadn't gotten it yet. And we sit down to eat lunch. What watch is Richard wearing? The same make, the same model. I'm going, what the? I used to have a Toyota Supra Turbo.
Yeah.
It was in 93 or something, whatever, yeah. Richard had a Lexus, same model year. And our license plates only differed by one number. Everything else was the same. It's back about, 15 years ago or so, I had to go have moles removed, one above my navel, one on each side of my thorax, and one in the back, forming like a perfect circle around my midsection.
Yeah.
Without, unbeknownst to me, on the same day, Richard went to his dermatologist. I didn't know where they were. He had moles removed from the same part of his body on the same day.
That's just weird.
Yeah, it's his father, Richard Matheson, passed away in 2013.
Mm.
And I learned about it. It was very upsetting. He was a great, great guy.
Yeah.
And I said, why is this date relevant? Other than, you know, more than his father passed, what does it mean? I went, oh, his father passed away on my father's birthday. In the 60s, I was surfing one day. And I got pulled under by, this was body surfing. I pulled under by a riptide or an undercurrent, whatever they call it. And I started drowning. I felt my lungs filling with water. Well, that's it. I'm going to die. I suddenly find myself standing in about 2.5 feet of water, and I have no idea how I got there. I'm going, what happened? I didn't tell anyone about the story. I was telling it to a director Richard and I met. He asked if we had ever fear of death, and I told him the story. And 4 years later, at the same beach, Richard had the exact same thing happen to him.
Wow.
And so it's really bizarre.
Yeah.
I mean, we used to get, when I lived in L.A., we used to get together for our birthday. We'd have lunch or dinner together. We'd shake hands and meet. And every time I shook his hand, I expected there to be a pop of light and one of us would disappear.
Yes.
Now, unlike me, Richard, things we don't share is Richard's tall. He's about 6'2", I guess. And he's got a thick head of dark hair. And I'm not tall, and I had dark hair, but most it's gray now, and it's thinned out. But so he got the height, he got the hair, he got the looks. He looked like a model or an actor, and he got the money. So at least one of us got it. But no, Richard's, we're good friends, and he's a great guy. We have a lot of common interests.
Well, listen, Barry, I just want to say thank you very much for allowing me a couple of hours of your time to have a chat about your career and your thoughts on parapsychology and your investigations. Where can everybody keep up to date with your work and find a copy of your book and look forward to the next one?
Okay. The book is no longer in print. You could find copies of it on eBay. Aliens Above, Ghosts Below, Explorations of the Unknown. My website is barrytaft.net, and it's a lot of, there's more detailing there than in my book, covering a lot of cases we've discussed today.
Mm-hmm.
As far as that, I'm on Facebook. I'm just writing the next book right now, which is more difficult than the first one because I've got a continuity. I have to make sure there's no continuity errors and no redundancy, things like that. Mm. So I'm writing it. It's busy. And, it's all I do, basically, is writing. I have to get another car because I had to sell my car 5 years ago when I got really sick.
Yeah.
I know where to put it. The only thing other than the paranormal that holds my interest is cars.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, yes, I'm glad you invited me on your show. It's been a lot of fun. And give out this information to people, and hopefully they'll be able to make use of it at some point.
No. Well, listen, thank you. You're always welcome. I look forward to the new book coming out, because I have a copy of your first book, and I highly recommend it if you can get hold of a copy for anybody that needs to track it down. I'll put links to everything in the show notes, but once again, Barry, thank you for your time.
No, my pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.